$68 billion. The income from opium production is shared between different groups. Again, according to the UNODC, $2 billion in opium profits goes into the pockets of the groups inside Afghanistan, and $66 billion goes to the drug mafia outside the country. That's while around $200 million goes to the armed insurgents. So three different groups catch fish from the murky water. First, the powerful drug mafia outside Afghanistan. Second, the Taliban and armed insurgents. And third, Afghan drug traffickers and farmers. From 2012 to 2013, crop eradication programs decreased 24% compared with the previous year. And currently, the profit generated by drug trade is more than Afghanistan's state budget, a fact contributing to the spread of corruption to all levels of the Afghan government, from the police to parliament.
Because of the transition situation in Afghanistan, the Afghan government has not been able to fully focus on the drug issue, because right now the Afghan government has been busy and preoccupied with the security transition, with economic transition, and with political transition.
As long as the central government remains too weak to improve security in the country, the areas under cultivation would generate huge profit for the drug traffickers. In her recent survey, German researcher Sita Maas suggests that in order to eradicate opium production in Afghanistan, all the politicians involved in the anti-narcotics campaign must be dismissed from their political posts.
As you know, I could not attend your last hearing because I was in Afghanistan, where there are high hopes for a successful election, bolstered by a stronger than expected showing of the Afghan military over the last several months. Yet this optimism is tempered with depressing evidence of persistent corruption, continued wasteful spending, and increased violence.
John F. Sopko, Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, believes that the Afghan government must have the political will to combat narcotics, what it is devoid of.
As with the question of the drug, corruption is a multifaceted challenge and problem. So if we tackle the corruption in Afghanistan, it will produce dividend in our ability to tackle the drug issue. So the two are interconnected, as also the question of terrorism, also these another interconnected factors with the drug and with the corruption.
Perhaps the best way to eradicate opium production in Afghanistan is to steer farmers away from drug trade towards alternative, legitimate crops like grapes, wheat, and saffron. Spraying poppy fields is also suggested as another available option for disrupting Afghanistan's lucrative opium market, though chemical spraying has never worked in the Golden Crescent. Experts believe that it is lax security in Afghanistan that gives the Taliban a free rein to cultivate poppies and smuggle drugs.
One important reason for both the production and the consumption of the drug is the question of poverty. Poverty provides the context, the excuse, and the attractiveness for some farmers in Afghanistan.
The majority of Afghan farmers work for big landlords, and the meager wages they earn are barely enough to get by. What's more, the lack of other viable options makes them work on poppy fields. Some farmers even have to marry their young daughters to their debtors. Opium trade accounts for 35% of Afghanistan's GDP. Against such a backdrop, poppy crop eradication is just chasing a mirage.
This is actually taking your face away from the reality, because they are attacking some other targets for insurgencies and Islamicism and things like that. And international forces, when I talk to them, they say our mandate is not poppy eradication. Our mandate is fight against terrorism. So we will fight against terrorism. They will not touch the farmers or things like that. He said, this is not our mandate.
Needless to say, it's a challenging task to close a Pandora's box of poppy cultivation, opium production, heroin processing labs, and drug trafficking. No doubt poppy cultivation is done inside Afghanistan, but heroin processing equipment cannot be manufactured there. It's no secret that NATO forces in the Golden Crescent turn a blind eye on farmers' activities, at least not to make enemies out of them.
Many people are very worried that if international community leaves Afghanistan, there might be a vacuum, there might be a civil war. Therefore, some farmers, mafias, they took advantage of that uncertainty and increased their production.
Experts say that opium production and export have increased considerably since the fall of the Taliban. Foreign forces in collusion with the Taliban have facilitated poppy cultivation and opium production and export to make drug trade in Afghanistan the main source of income for some countries in the world. It's not possible to export such a huge amount of drug from Afghanistan without the involvement of state officials, foreign forces, and international networks. On the 11th of December 2010, the New York Times published an article on the relationship between the United States government and drug lords like Juma Khan. As the biggest and most dangerous drug lord in Afghanistan, Juma Khan was arrested and transported to New York to face charges under a new American narco-terrorism law in 2008. That's while Mr. Juma was a longtime American informer who provided information about the Taliban, Afghan corruption, and other drug traffickers. Along the way, he was also paid a large amount of cash by the United States. According to the article, in his heyday, Mr. Juma Khan was secretly flown to Washington for a series of clandestine meetings with CIA and DEA officials in 2006. John F. Sopko, Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, has confessed that the international community has failed in reducing poppy cultivation in Afghanistan and in cutting the Taliban off the drug money. Likewise, U.S. officials believe that they have not been successful in combating narcotics in Afghanistan, in spite of the $7 billion budget they spent for this purpose. American experts estimate that the Taliban might have received around $360 million over the past decade. European countries are the biggest consumers of Afghan-produced heroin. Narcotics production in Afghanistan is growing at an alarming rate. Apart from the local Afghans, people in neighboring countries and those located on the transit route used for smuggling those drugs to Europe are affected. Iran shares the longest border with Afghanistan and is the first country on the transit route to Europe. And as a result, it has incurred huge human and financial costs. Iran is at the forefront of a full-scale war against drugs destined for Europe. The more the drugs produced in Afghanistan, the more difficult the job for Iran, and the more the perils against the security of Europe.
best thing about Ayatollah Hadi Ma'rifat is that he was the one who made an independent book or an encyclopedia about Quranic sciences. We can see that he has referred to the Shia ulama and the Sunni ulama. But obviously, the thing which he has done, obviously, this was for the first time.
Briefly speaking, he dedicates himself to the sciences of the Quran, and he spends the rest of his life, 40 years of his life, doing research on that, and the result of that is the most comprehensive and the largest book on the sciences of the Quran in the Shi'i seminary that has ever been authored, and that is At-Tamhid fi Ulum al-Quran.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRabi English Radio. This is the teacher, and I am Atta, the host of this program. For today's discussion, I've invited two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Dr. Murtaza Zazadeh and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, and we want to continue our discussion regarding the works and the life of the late Ayatollah Muhammad Hadi Ma'rifat. Dr. Zazadeh, assalamu alaikum, welcome to your show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, thank you.
You're welcome. And Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, thanks for inviting.
Regarding the main studies and the researchers that were done by the late Ayatollah Muhammad Hadi Ma'rifat, we have to refer to one of the volumes of the book of At-Tamhid under the title of Siyanat al-Qur'an min at-Tahrif, which was also published in a separate book. But it is included among the main scholarly researchers of Ayatollah Muhammad Hadi Ma'rifat in At-Tamhid fi Ulum al-Quran. Roughly, Sayyid Mohsen, we can translate into the protection of the Holy Quran against distortion or misinterpretation. First of all, tell us what is the reason and what was the main reason for the late Ayatollah Ma'rifat to compile such a book regarding Quranic sciences.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think we mentioned in the previous episode that in answer to Zahabi, Ayatollah Ma'rifat has wrote three volumes, basically.
Yes.
Two volumes were about the Tafsir and Mufassirun.
Okay.
And one volume was the same, Siyanat al-Quran min al-Tahrif, protection of Quran from the distortion or misinterpretation. This was one of the reasons. The second reason is this is the part of the Quranic sciences itself.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is a discussion throughout the history that was there any distortion or misinterpretation of the Quran or change in the Quran?
Change in the Quran.
Yes.
Okay.
Which means like not in the meaning, but in actual wordings of the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
Was any verse being changed or removed? We can say like deleted
or replaced
from.
Replaced. Okay.
So this is what we mean from the mm-hmm. distortion in the Quran or the change in the verses of the Quran.
That's right.
The Shia school of thought says, like, if someone has such a belief that the wordings are changed, he does not disbelieve in Quran.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's two things.
Yes.
Once you totally reject Quran being the book of Allah and it's been revealed, and once someone, if he believes, like, there was a change in it, a slight change, this is different.
That's right.
In the Shia school of thought, they say, no, if someone has this kind of belief that there's a slight change or change in the Quran, his belief is wrong. But he does not become kafir or disbeliever. And the reason is that, for example, we have in Islam, there is a school of thought. Being a Shia, we believe that all the prophets are infallible in revelation and in their general life. There are some school of thought who says like the prophets are only infallible when they receive the revelation, but in their personal life, they are fallible. So this is another kind of, when they can have such a belief and in the same time they can remain a Muslim.
That's right.
Where they're making a prophet and a fallible person in his personal life. When they can remain as a Muslim, why a person who believes or have a belief like there was a change cannot be a Muslim? Yes, their beliefs are wrong.
That's right.
And being a Shia, we strongly condemn this idea that there was a change. We believe that there is no change. Why? Because these are the clear wordings of the Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran, that we have revealed this Quran, inna nahnu nazzalna dhikra wa inna lahu lahafizun.
That's all right.
Certainly we are the protector of this Quran. So this is from the very basic beliefs of the Shiaism.
That's right.
And the belief there is no change in the Quran that was revealed on the Prophet.
the same Quran is in our hands. In
sometimes they condemn the Shia world, you have a different Quran. Dear Muslims, we have the same Quran as you have. But Dr. Reza Zadeh, there have been some scholars during the history of Islam who has compiled some books and treatises,
yes,
and dissertations regarding the distortion of the Holy Quran. What is their argument,
yes,
and what was the answer of Ayatollah Ma'rifati?
Mm-hmm. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. That's a very good question, and that's a very sensitive and actually controversial discussion that has been posed in many different ways in the Islamic world, especially in the last century, and particularly after, let's say, Wahhabis started a big campaign against the Shi'i beliefs and to say everything correct or incorrect, and a lot of accusations against the Shi'i.
Yes.
So one of the things that they used in order to deface Shi'ism was a big lie that the Shi'as believe in the distortion of the Quran. And they brought a lot of, you know, different reasons for that. One of the things that they used was a book that was authored by a Shia scholar, I mean, in the last century.
Yes.
It's not a very old book, but in that book, the late scholar Haji Nuri, who was the author of that book, he wrote
Muhaddith Nuri,
who was an expert in the field of hadith and narrations,
right,
of the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. He wrote a book in order to somehow, that sounds like that book wants to prove or bring arguments that the Quran has been distorted. This is what,
okay,
the book looks to be about, I mean, and that's what the book wants to say.
That's right.
And that book made a lot of big problems in the Shi'i communities, because there is no doubt that neither the Sunni scholars nor the Shia scholars throughout the history believe that Quran has been distorted.
Mm-hmm.
But when we say distortion, we need to have a very clear understanding of what do we mean by distortion.
By tahrif.
Yeah, by tahrif.
That's right.
And that is actually, I want to go into the book,
yes,
itself that was written by Ayatollah Ma'rifat. That is actually the first chapter of the book that was written by Ayatollah Ma'rifat, Siyanatul Quran, Tahrif, Protection of the Quran from Distortion. So he first talks about tahrif, the meaning, the let's say terminology of,
okay,
distortion, and also the technical meaning,
yes,
of distortion, and he explains this. But briefly speaking, when we say distortion, Quran has been protected from distortion, and this is a common belief among all the Muslims around the world, although a couple of scholars throughout the history have,
yes,
said something against it or have said something different, but this never means that Shias or Sunnis have ever believed in the distortion. From this protection, we mean that what we have today in Bayn al-Daffatayn, I mean, between these two covers of the,
yes,
Quran, this book that we have with ourselves, the words are exactly the words that have been revealed to the Prophet. They are the words that existed at the time of the Prophet and have never been changed throughout the history. This is what we mean. The words are exactly the same.
That's right.
This is so anything that any idea suggests that the words of the Quran have been changed,
okay,
either something has been added,
okay,
or anything has been removed,
okay,
from it, this is a distortion in the text of the Quran. This has been absolutely, I mean, very clearly rejected by all the scholars.
But sorry,
this is what we mean by tahrif. But there is a second type of
distortion. The mere discussion about tahrif,
mm-hmm,
and just choosing it as your academic field of study does not make any problem, isn't it?
Of course it doesn't. No.
Okay,
because
some say when you are choosing tahrif, it means that according to a presupposition, you are getting into the Holy Quran. Like,
yeah,
maybe,
yeah,
what,
you know, these are not very scholarly ways of,
okay,
thinking, because that's a very, you know, academic and scholarly question to ask. Okay, are these words the same words that existed at the time of the Prophet? Has anything added? Has anything been removed? This,
okay,
is a very, I mean, simple question that can be asked.
And sorry, can we say that Muhaddis Nuri's look in his book,
right,
Fastul Khattab, you know, was based on some of the narrations and,
exactly,
traditions which were not authentic,
so
that's why he made such a book?
Yeah, so to complete,
mm-hmm,
what I was saying, I can answer your question based on that. You know, the second type of distortion is distortion in the meaning of the Quran.
Uh-huh.
That's something completely different. It means that there has been a text that does not have any change from the time of the Prophet up until today, But then the interpretation of that, the commentary of that, the understanding of that, how we want the exegesis of that, how we want to, let's say, interpret those words to the people can be wrong.
That's right.
If distortion is used in this meaning, this is something, I mean, very self-evident.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can start, any other person can start translating, interpreting the Quran
right.
in a wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
So the Shia and the Sunni scholars, because there are some hadith in the sources, both Shias and Sunnis.
That's
no
right.
one should think that these are only available in the
Shia
sources.
Word, that's right.
That look like they are talking about the distortion of the Quran. The scholars always say that, look, those narrations that sound like they are talking about some type of
mm-hmm.
distortion, all of them are of two types. One type that are authentic narrations, they talk about a type of distortion in the meaning of the Quran. It means that some unqualified people
mm-hmm.
who were so-called scholars, they misinterpreted the Quran.
Okay.
This type of distortion is something that is happening every day. I mean,
mm-hmm.
by different by people who
yes.
are not qualified.
Yes.
So that is one thing. And the second type of the hadith that we have are not
authentic.
Or
are weak in chain of narration.
Exactly. So
Sanad
the main answer.
That's right.
Exactly. The main answer that we have to that the scholars gave to Muhaddith Nuri
mm-hmm.
and also Sunni scholars who had some type of
That's right.
similar ideas was that those hadiths that they are using
mm-hmm.
are either weak,
okay.
so they cannot be accepted,
okay.
they have been fabricated by people,
yes.
or they are not talking about distortion in the text. They are talking about distortion in the meaning and misinterpreting
okay.
The Quran, that is something completely different.
That's all right. Thank you very much. Dr. Azadeh, for a beautiful explanation.
Okay,
do you have any
one thing we need to, yes, remember that, you know, we need to be careful when there is a propaganda against someone.
Yes.
By wordings of one person, we cannot just apply the rule on the whole nation.
Yes.
For example, if for example, Muhaddith Nuri was believing in the distortion of the Quran, this does not mean the whole Shia community
okay.
Believes that. So this is what we need to, obviously, when there's a scholarly discussion, we need to be very much careful. For example, you know, when we're talking about the Sunni sources, in the Sahih Sita, we have some narrations. Especially, for example, there's a hadith from Aisha. She says, like, there was, you know, at the time of the Prophet, there was a hadith. And there were some verses of the Quran which were on a paper, but when the demise of the Prophet happened, a goat came and it ate those leaves because
mm-hmm.
it was written on the leaves, and I couldn't find them. So there are many narrations which are very weak.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the chain is weak,
yes.
or the topic is weak,
That's
and
right.
We do not believe them. There are many
we
things.
We cannot put our exegesis on
yes.
the Holy Quran based on these weak narrations.
Based on these weak narrations. So there are many narrations. Obviously, we have to see the whole chain. And that is the main criteria.
That's right.
These are some of the examples
right.
that we find in the history. But obviously, being a Shia, we totally do not believe in such narrations.
Yes.
And in Sunni school of thought, obviously, their scholars have also answered
okay.
for such narrations that these are weak and we do not believe. So
from cover to cover, the Quran is complete as it was revealed to
exactly.
Prophet Muhammad. But discussion and doing research regarding the distortion of the Holy Quran is allowed in all the schools of
Absolutely.
Thought, and they can do research on that. And this is a beautiful field of study which was tackled by the late Ayatollah Muhammad Hadi Ma'rifat. Thank you much, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Dr. Reza Zadeh, for your presence
welcome.
In this program. May Allah bless the soul of this scholar, that is the late Ayatollah Muhammad Hadi Ma'rifat. He is buried in the holy city of Qom, in vicinity of the holy shrine of Hazrat Mahthuma. What is important is that these scholars have dedicated their lives to a specific topic, you know, and for 40, 50 years, maybe
yes.
half a century, you know, they spend their life in dedication to one topic, that is Quranic studies, At-Tamhid fi Ulum al-Quran, a really nice book and encyclopedia that can be used and read out by all the Muslims around the world, regardless of their sect, being Shia or being Sunni. May Allah bless his soul. And dear listeners, you can also listen to the other episodes of the program, The Teacher, regarding Ayatollah Ma'rifat on parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page, also a YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
Let's discuss Imam Khomeini, may Allah bless his soul. We all owe him, all of us, those who know and those who don't know. Those of us who know, we don't know enough. The sayings of the Ahlul Bayt, saying that there will come a time that from Qum, the knowledge of the Ahlul Bayt will cover the corners of the earth, that has come true through the efforts of Imam Khomeini, may Allah bless his soul. If we know more about the Ahlul Bayt, it's because of the revolution. If we have more books available, it's because of the revolution. If we have more involved youth in Islam, it's because of the revolution. If we have more spirituality, it's because of the revolution. If we know Ayatollah Bahjat, it's because of the revolution. If we've heard of Sayyid Qadi Tabatabai, it's because of the revolution. If we have access to the tafsir of Allama Tabatabai, it's because of the revolution. If we have access to the works of Shaheed Mutahari, it's because of the revolution. Revolution is the work of the effort of this divine man, Imam Khomeini, may Allah bless his soul. This man that saw nothing but Allah, worshipped no one but Allah, feared no one but Allah, relied on no one but Allah, did nothing for the pleasure of anything except and anyone except for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He has left us on this occasion. And of course, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gifted us with another Khomeini, which, as the verse says, and Shahid Das Ghaib mentioned, is either better or the same as Imam Khomeini. May Allah bless his soul and bless our leader. Bless us with the continued presence of that leader until he is able to hand over the banner to the 12th Imam, Ajjalallah Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. But this leader is also the work of Imam Khomeini. As he has said, he follows the teachings of Imam Khomeini. He was trained by the school of thought of Imam Khomeini. He got trained through the experiences following the teachings of Imam Khomeini, his view of and his perspective on the Quran. The Quran was there. The hadith was there. The words of Sayyid al-Shuhada were there. The words of Amir al-Mu'mineen were there. The words of the 12th Imam were there. The words of the Prophet were there. The words of Allah, the Quran, are there. However, unfortunately, the perspectives, the way that was being read, the verse in Tansurullah yansurkum wa yuthabbit aqdamana has been there. Aqdamakum has been there. If you help and assist God's cause, He will assist you. He will help you. That verse has always been there. But why did for so long so many of those who knew more than the average believer, looking at the same verses, did not come to the conclusion that we can stand against the oppressors and Allah will assist us? Why did they say we don't have the means? The Quran says, I will provide you the means. That's the perspective that Imam Khomeini had in reading that Quran, reading the words of the Ahlul Bayt, seeing it as they said it, not with any dust, with any veil on any part of it. With full certainty in every single letter of the words of the Quran and the Ahlul Bayt, Salamullah alayhim ajma'in. This perspective, the perspective that sees Imam al-Kadhim being a lion in the battlefield, not a coward person in the prison. So two different readings. They're both there. Some people's reading of Imam al-Kadhim is someone who is in a prison, chained up, locked up. Imam Khomeini's perspective that is expressed more in the words of Ayatollah Khamenei, may Allah protect him, is that no, he's a lion there, outside the prison and inside the prison. Not because some random story of him affecting, influencing someone spiritually and they like the Ahlul Bayt. This is bare minimum. They created such fear in the hearts of the tyrants that ruled over them. The Mal'oon Harun that called himself al-Rashid, he considered himself such a great ruler, ruthless ruler. Everyone was afraid of Harun al-Rashid. Imam al-Kadhim brought him to his knees. He had no choice but to kill Imam al-Kadhim. But he was so afraid of that sin being on him, he left the city so that when Imam al-Kadhim is killed, they don't see it as the work of Harun. It's out of his fear. This is Imam al-Kadhim, Imam al-Sadiq, Imam al-Baqir, Imam al-Sajjad, Imam al-Mujtaba. All the Imams. This is the reading of Imam Khomeini, the leader, learned to read Islam as it is, and not a skewed version. In any aspect, there were many aspects, alhamdulillah, maraja, ulama, they tried to clarify as best they could, but there were certain areas that were covered by dust, ages, these concepts were not thought of, spoken of, in a Muslim world. The Muslim world was being ruled by kufr, which is contrary to the teachings of Islam. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, you're not allowed to allow the kuffar to rule over you. You're not allowed to. But they were ruling all over Muslim lands. What were Muslims doing? Nothing. What happened to that teaching of the Quran? Why didn't ulama talk about that? Why wasn't that being mentioned? Why wasn't the promise of Allah for support being mentioned repeatedly? Don't worry. Why weren't the verses of sacrifice, the verses of istishhad, the verses of fighting, the verses of giving life, the verses of martyrdom being recited? But Imam Khomeini came, liberated the hearts, liberated the minds, took us back to the teachings of the Quran.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adim Alim Halim Hakim Matim.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing the Netflix documentary Get Me Roger Stone, directed by Dylan Bank, Daniel DeMauro, and Morgan Penny. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Zach Cochran, who is an anti-racist activist with the campaign group Stand Up to Racism. Now, Get Me Roger Stone explores the life and career of the American political strategist Roger Stone, who is known as the dark mastermind behind Donald Trump's presidential campaign and is arguably responsible for putting him in the White House. Stone is a self-proclaimed dirty trickster, and this documentary exposes Stone as a man who knows no bounds when it comes to winning in politics.
Loves the game, he has fun with it, and he's very good at it.
I'm an agent provocateur.
Political strategist.
Controversial as you can get.
An incredible capacity for treachery.
Win-at-all-cost mentality.
When people think of Washington corruption, they think of Roger Stone.
Those who say I have no soul, those who say I have no principles, are losers. Those are bitter losers.
There's really nobody quite like Roger Stone.
The Nixon tattoo is really all you need to know about Roger.
We really pioneered negative campaign advertising.
He created the modern sleazeball lobbyist.
Washington's been worse for it ever since.
Stone's rule, it is better to be infamous than never be famous at all. He
got chased out of Washington.
He's looking to see if he can find an angle.
I was like a jockey looking for a horse. You can't win the race if you don't have a horse.
Roger saw something that nobody else saw back in the early 80s.
I suggested that Trump should explore a bid for the presidency.
Who created Donald Trump as a political figure?
You're the biggest
lie, loser.
What have I lied about?
Have you spoken with the WikiLeaks founder?
You're a rape denier.
Roger, you can't just say that.
You have to be outrageous to get noticed.
I revel in your hatred, because if I weren't effective, you wouldn't hate me.
First of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. And Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on Get Me, Roger Stone?
Well, the trailer really gets the tone of the film. It's done in this kind of lively, jaunty, comedic tone. But the material is just bone-chilling. It's absolutely horrifying to watch it, especially as it goes back kind of 40 years in the past, 50 years even, to him working with Nixon and Reagan and Bush and, I mean, basically all of the kind of slightly shady campaigns that have gone on over the years.
It is surprisingly funny, as you say.
But it's done with this kind of sense of humor, kind of because he's so unapologetic about it. He doesn't make any bones about it. He talks about using lies and deception in all of his work and how he's very proud of doing that. And it's pretty horrifying. And also the fact that he's been working with Trump since the early 80s, which I didn't know that before, and I'd heard of him. I mean, he's been in the news. But I didn't know that he's been basically grooming Trump to be president since he met him, because he thought, oh, this is quite a quirky character that the people seem to love. Maybe he'd be a good one.
It just gave
me the chills.
And what about you, Zach? What was your take on what Get Me, Roger Stone, and had you heard of him before?
I'd never heard of Roger Stone, but absolutely very watchable program. For many people, with Trump's election, it sent shocks around the world. To actually get some insight into how Donald Trump could have been elected, I think was very, very interesting. And to see, as Richard has said, that over four decades now, Roger Stone has not only been grooming guys like Donald Trump, but has been involved in countless campaigns. But also, we hear about the power of US lobbying firms, but to see one of the guys who was instrumental in this kind of sleazeball politics and how he unapologetically promoted that was very, very interesting, yeah.
I think the character you're talking about is Paul Manafort, and we're going to dissect his character a bit later on. But I must say, I think we can all agree that when Donald Trump won the presidency, it took nearly everyone by surprise, and many thought it was merely a publicity stunt. But after watching this documentary, you get a sense that there is, in fact, a method behind all the madness. And did you get that feeling as well, Rich?
Well, yeah, there's definitely this sense that, I mean, Roger Stone claims he's just an agent provocateur. All he wants to do is shake up the system. He doesn't care about helping people, so he doesn't have any of those political values that you would think a political leader should have. He just wants to shake things up. So Trump is his perfect candidate, and you can see how he honed his skills through Nixon and Reagan and Bush. And then it all pays off for him and Trump, which means that we all pay for it. It's a pretty frightening depiction of the way that this thing unfolded over all these years. You kind of think of Trump as being a fairly recent thing because he's only emerged on the scene in the last year or two as a serious candidate. But actually, this has been in the works. So
years in the making.
Yeah.
In 1987, I suggested that Trump should explore a bid for the presidency.
This sounds like political presidential talk to me, and I know people have talked to you about whether or not you want to run. Would you ever?
Probably not, but I do get tired of seeing what's happening with this country, and if it got so bad, I would never want to rule it out totally, because I really am tired of seeing what's happening with this country.
I was like a jockey looking for a horse. You can't win the race if you don't have a horse. I interceded with the Portsmouth, New Hampshire Chamber of Commerce to arrange a lunch. The helicopter landing was as big a news as his speech. This is kind of the first time I saw the power of Trump. The public interest in Trump was palpable. It was like electric. And he lit the place on fire.
That comment, I was a jockey looking for a horse. I mean, as despicable of a character Stone is, he is quite funny, if you give him that at least. And Rich, Stone takes a lot of credit for putting Trump in the White House. What do you make of this?
Well, I mean, he basically created Trump as a political figure, and you hear Stone use all the words that Trump uses in his speeches. So you realize that Roger Stone has been feeding him all of these lines, all of these famous lines that we think of Trump as saying, originated in Roger Stone. And the film also kind of documents the whole kind of shady political situation where Stone was part of the campaign, then dropped out of the campaign, but really didn't. That was just a public ruse, and then kind of secretly was still running things. And it's all very dodgy, but Stone is just totally unapologetic about all of it. He just admits the whole thing. He admits that it's a big ruse. It's a trick to trick the voters into voting for someone like this.
He is famous for being infamous.
Yeah.
And Zach, I want to bring you in here because you're with the Stand Up to Racism, and you've organized numerous protests against Donald Trump when he was inaugurated and the Muslim ban. And surely you protest not just Donald Trump as an individual, but people like Roger Stone and what they stand for.
Absolutely. This is what was so useful about this film, was to get an insight into the kind of politics that were pushing Donald Trump. And I actually want to say this process, what became clear from the film, goes back to Nixon. Actually, Nixon came to power in 1968. There was a book at the time by one of his advisors, Kevin Phillips, that talked about the emerging Republican majority, about channeling the voters' resentment. And that largely played out in turning the economic insecurities of white Americans into resentments towards black. It was a key strategy of Nixon. And we see this through the film when they talk about racist coding, the language is being used, pushed through a number of candidates, but particularly with Donald Trump. We see the appalling election campaign. He ran the Muslim ban, the scapegoating of Mexicans, saying he would build the wall with Mexico. It's clear that Roger Stone was absolutely instrumental in encouraging Trump to go down this racist rhetoric, which had wider ramifications.
Well, and the whole birther movement, which was Roger Stone created that whole thing about Donald Trump chasing Obama for his birth certificate was a Roger Stone create. That was his little, and that was a racist campaign that was playing into the hands of those right wing people who have those views, who don't feel like they can express them and feel marginalized, and it's all about manipulating the people, isn't it?
So are you saying that Stone is actually as influential as he makes out to be in the world of politics?
I think he's very influential. I'm not convinced that he's actually racist. I think he's manipulating people's opinions and people's, you know, the way people feel. But he is very influential, quite clearly.
Unfortunately so. And Zach, Stone says in the documentary that Stone says that Trump is sort of this anti-establishment figure. And how is it that people perceive him to be this way, and is it accurate?
I think what we absolutely have to say, and it was brought out in the film, Trump was able to fill a vacuum. We've seen, not just in America, but a number of countries, the hollowing out of politics. The establishment, there's been deep dissatisfaction with them, years of neoliberal policies, and Trump was able to come in and channel that anti-establishment sentiment, not by offering people policies, redistribution of wealth, but by encouraging people to draw conclusions like scapegoating the Muslim community and migrant communities as well.
Mm-hmm. And in the documentary, Roger says that, someone that he's interviewed says about Roger that he understands democracy and that democracy is appealing to the process of the majority. How accurate is this, and what do you make this claim in the film that Stone understands democracy?
Well, yeah, obviously, because he's appealing to these opinions that are unvoiced, and so he's tapping into the majority of people, the way that they feel, and which is kind of horrifying.
Mm-hmm. And does Trump represent the majority of America?
No, I think absolutely not. If you look at this is the such a worrying thing. His policies, he wants to cut corporation tax to record lows, roll back on initiatives to tackle climate change, things that do not benefit ordinary Americans. You know, the population, we're richest country in the world, yet a quarter of the population live in poverty, and this is a billionaire. But it's absolutely by scapegoating, deflecting blame at the establishment. It's a bogus anti-establishment. What we see very clearly from this film, Stone, his close advisor, has been involved with Manafort, who we're going to come on to.
Actually, I'm glad you brought him up because we're about to go to him just now. So just pause there for now.
Trump asked me to get involved because my reputation, among other things in politics, is understanding of the convention process, the delegate process, and most of the major successful big conventions over the last 30 years
I've been intimately involved in.
Did Roger recommend you for the job?
Roger was one of the two or three people who strongly recommended me, yes.
Is it a surprise that Paul Manafort wound up as the campaign chairman for Trump? No, of course not. That was engineered by Roger as a way to get Corey Lewandowski bounced out of the campaign. It took a couple months, but they did it. Roger has had a guiding hand in all of this. Now, Trump is hard to guide. He spits the bit out, but Roger's had as much influence on the campaign as anyone.
I think the campaign's been professionalized. Manafort's doing a phenomenal job. I think he instills confidence in the campaign that they didn't have before.
Did you give any reporters background on Lewandowski?
No.
Okay, so do you sort of...
Roger is not an official part of the campaign.
Did he bring you in?
No.
You were just talking about Paul Manafort and how much of a shady character he is. And considering his relationship with dictators, his role in lobbying, what contribution did he make to Donald Trump's campaign team?
It was clear when Roger Stone was fired, with denies being fired, the fact Manafort suggests that Stone recommended him and was absolutely crucial in using some of those dirty tactics to get Donald Trump elected. It shows just how bogus this idea of Trump being anti-establishment is, because Manafort's been involved with countless presidents over the decades and played the same role.
And Rich, why is it that Paul Manafort, we know that he has a relationship with Roger Stone, but denies him being involved in the campaign? I mean, is this all part of the plan? What is going on here?
I just think it's part of the way that they present one thing to the public and they talk about something. I mean, all through this film, they're talking to the cameras, because the cameras are following these people all over the place. They say one thing to the camera, then it cuts to a statement like that where Paul Manafort's on television saying exactly the opposite. So they very carefully script what they say in public, and they don't care that it's not the truth. It's all about creating this image that gets them where they want to go, and they don't really care about what they have to do to get there.
And isn't that disturbing, Zach, that these politicians are lying through their teeth? Don't they think that people can see right through this and hold them to account?
They've had many decades of perfecting the strategy. It's interesting that the film starts with Roger Stone talking about as a kid in the school canteen in a mock election, where he, at the time, ironically, is back in JFK, and he tells all the other kids that Nixon will make you go to school on Saturday to win this mock election. He said he learned there the value of disinformation, and we've seen this process throughout his political career, and it is very worrying. It makes a mockery of democracy and allows them to distort politics in the interest of those at the top.
Mm. And Rich, we know that Roger Stone is dubbed as the political dirty trickster. What examples do we see in this documentary of his other stunts?
Well, I mean, all of the stuff, all of the crooked Hillary stuff, you know, just suddenly creating this huge cloud of suspicion around the Clintons, around Obama, just everything that kind of, it's just this huge cloud of misinformation that just goes around, and everybody starts to wonder, well, what's the truth? And it's very hard to pick the truth out of it, especially if you're leaning toward that angle. He talks very openly about the fact that he doesn't believe in any of the political points of the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. He identifies as a libertarian, he says.
Yeah, and he says he doesn't believe in their any of their policies. And yet he put a Republican in the White House, and mm-hmm. he doesn't care.
And what does Stone get out of all of this?
I don't know. Do you think he just enjoys the power of disrupting the system? He just seems like a pure disruptor, doesn't he?
Absolutely. One thing I'll say, I suppose, in terms of his libertarian leanings, I think going back to Nixon, if you look at the 1960s, it was a time in rising struggles, particularly the civil rights movement. Nixon was the kind of block against that. It's why he's got so much respect for Nixon. I think he's very much...
He has a big tattoo of Nixon on his back.
Yes.
And he flashes that throughout the documentary.
He does, and I think going back to the question of racism, I think it's why it becomes such a key issue. Haldeman, who was a chief of staff under Nixon, wrote in one of his diaries, Nixon said, the problem was essentially the blacks. And what he meant by that was black struggle became the nexus for other social struggles. It was leading to concessions being won, social reforms on the system. So he knew that... drawing back the civil rights struggles and the black struggles was absolutely crucial. That's why I think racism has played such a key role in some of his tactics. As you said, he might not necessarily have massive racist leanings, but he knew it was essential to push forward this kind of libertarian model that he does agree with, which is a rolling back of state intervention.
Yeah, he knew he had to play that racism card in order to win votes, essentially. And I want to actually ask you more about that a bit later on.
Now the children's table is the adult table, and Alex Jones is, you know, passing the dinner rolls, and we're all conspiracy American now.
Even if Donald Trump loses, I still win, because the Stone brand has been front and center, and my brand of politics have finally come into their own. CNN, MSNBC, they're now the fringe. Alt-right communications, we are the mainstream.
Did Trump really believe that Obama was not born in the United States? Does Roger Stone really believe that Bill Clinton raped all these women? You know, it doesn't matter to them is more the point. For them, there are no boundaries. Anything goes. Anything that wins, fine.
If you read Roger's blog, The Stone Zone, or follow him on Twitter, it's like coming attractions for the attacks Donald Trump will be launching 2 weeks later.
It is Hillary who hires the heavy-handed pride detectives who break into these women's homes and ransack them, who threaten their children, who kill their pets.
She's married to a man who was the worst abuser of women in the history of politics. And Hillary was an enabler, and she treated these women horribly.
Roger's, you know, relationship with Trump has been so interconnected that it's hard to define what's Roger and what's Donald. While it will be clearly a Trump presidency, I think it's influenced by a Stone philosophy.
That notion of win at any cost pretty much summarizes Stone's brand of politics. And there's so much to dissect from that clip. And Rich, if we look at the mainstream media angle, Roger Stone and Donald Trump were able to discredit the media, and the media became powerless against them. How were the campaign team able to do this, and why was this so effective?
I find it just shocking that they've been able to kind of marginalize all the mainstream and bring in people like Alex Jones and Breitbart as kind of the voice of this generation. I find it just horrifying that people are going there.
Alex Jones is, of course, the famous conspiracy theorist.
Insane conspiracy theorist, like far right wing, and really frightening. I mean, the clips that you see of him are pretty hilarious, actually, because he's just completely rabid and crazy.
But he's part of this,
and it's this disruptive presence. It's trying to shake the system up and create a smaller government and let people do what they want. And it's not really the Republican agenda, but they're using the Republican Party to do it. And
yeah, that is a very interesting point. And yeah. Zach, I want to get your thoughts on this sort of fake news era that we're in and post-truth era.
Yeah, I mean, it's very worrying, the clip with Roger Stone's where he said the NBC's, the CNN, actually, they're marginalized now, the Breitbart, and the more alt-right communications. It might be a slight exaggeration, but of becoming the more mainstream news source. It's something the author Tariq Ali called about the extreme center. It's coming into the mainstream, which is very, very concerning, because this has a ripple effects, actually. It gives a confidence to the far right. Some of the appalling attacks we saw after the Trump presidency, because the platform given to the prominent far right blogs such as Breitbart is very concerning.
And how are left-wing groups trying to combat this?
I think what was very interesting over here, and that is I forget the name of the blog in the States, but certainly over here you saw the election of Jeremy Corbyn, that social media was absolutely instrumental in that. The work of momentum were combating the government's austerity agenda and helping to push some of Corbyn's policies forward. And it had a bigger impact in getting to young people in the general election.
So there's still some hope, I see. And I think, going back to the documentary, I think one of the funniest lines that Roger Stone says is that politics is show business for ugly people. But on a serious note, I mean, is this what politics has been reduced to now, Rich? I mean, is this merely a freak show, a circus, and not serving the best interests of the people anymore?
Well, you kind of hope that this will snap people out of it. It's like the fact that Donald Trump was elected president should make everybody stop and say, wait a minute, something's horribly wrong here. You know, the fact that Britain voted